Disrespect will take you places you can't get to from here. Disrespect entertains with a look at the challenges and sometimes the successes of people with disabilities who have taken from them or are denied the full choice of possibilities to affect for the better their own lives or the lives of those above them. Disrespect welcomes David Blazek, certified financial planner and advisor with LifeTrust Financial Planning. David's going to talk to us about how people with disabilities can free up money and receive more money for income security in the future. Welcome to the show.
Thanks, Jeff.
For me, it's easy to be skeptical when you talk about freeing up money on an income of $1,000 a month, or if you're on OW and disabled, $570 a month. How can somebody on that kind of income actually get more money that if they can manage to live on that income, they can use to enhance their income security?
Well, it's a question I've often asked, and unfortunately people don't realize that although they may be claiming benefits through proper tax planning, there's an oversight in a very critical area, and that's called the disability non-refundable tax credit.
Okay. And that's federal?
That's a federal benefit.
All right.
Now, although it's often claimed, the failure to recognize one has to pay tax in order to receive a tangible benefit.
Yeah, okay. Or owe tax, yeah.
And sadly, what's overlooked is the support of a family
member, yeah,
that can take advantage of this credit.
I understand if you file a tax return and you apply for a credit, you can take advantage of it if you owe income tax. How can your family take advantage of it?
By transferring the person with the disability to a family member.
Mm-hmm.
And
that doesn't entail any loss of freedom or any restriction on choices of the person with the disability.
Not at all.
Okay.
Matter of fact, it enhances the likelihood of that party, the disabled party, receiving a substantial benefit. It's predicated on the ability to pay tax, and a non-refundable tax benefit is a reimbursement of taxes paid. Thus, there's a pretty broad spectrum of family members who can claim on your behalf.
Oh, who?
Well, we can start from mother, dad, and then siblings.
Mm-hmm.
And we can go as far as field as a niece.
Mm-hmm.
And just last week, it was known to me that a stepson, because of his relationship, is also entitled to claim.
All right.
Now, tangibly, what does this mean? It means approximately $1,600 a year.
Okay.
In tax savings.
Tax savings. So this isn't the credit against income. This is the actual savings in the tax paid. Okay.
Right to the bottom line.
All right.
And again, I must make this point, a very key one, is as each year rolls over, we're on a rolling 10-year eligibility. So, for instance, the failure to claim...
Backdating, 10-year backdating.
In eligibility, we can backdate 10 years...
Right.
...if the eligibility has been missed.
Okay.
But I want to underscore that this disability tax certificate we will lose that $1,600 for 1999 as we roll over.
Yeah. Okay.
Come January of this year.
Okay.
So it's critical that the disability tax credit is
implemented as soon as you can.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So what's involved in qualifying for the disability tax credit and splitting it? You have to be in some way assisted by the family member, don't you, to split the income with them?
That's correct. Good point.
And you can you create that kind of relationship with a family member if you need to?
Going forward, if there hasn't been an established pattern in the past based on three areas, Canadian Revenue Agency consider necessities of life.
Oh, okay.
They are, one, shelter.
Right.
Food.
Uh-huh.
And clothing.
So if you need assistance with one of those.
That's correct.
All right. Okay. Is there a low limit on the assistance?
There has to be some, although no receipts are required, there has to be some legitimized care in providing these necessities for their loved one.
So someone would look for a substantial gift or some kind of recurring amount, however low.
Well, if we can just zero in on shelter, for instance, if I may, often it's come to my attention that there's a revelation of repairs done to a home or residence.
Oh yeah, okay.
In addition, there may be a hydro bill that's paid.
Yeah.
Property taxes.
Yeah.
Those would be some instances.
So any help with those is support.
And one would validate the Canadian Revenue Agency's necessities of life parameters.
Okay. Good. Good. So if you receive any of that kind of help, you can go ahead with this.
Now, to answer your question, well, how do you jumpstart this? Forms can be mailed, downloaded, or sourced in Hamilton here at the Bay Street office of the Canadian Revenue Agency.
Mm-hmm.
And the technical word for the form is called the T. T as in Tom, 2201.
Okay.
After it's secured, then one has to formalize a meeting with your physician, who then has to fill out a medical history.
And he has to be aware that to meet the tax credit, you have to show some limits, some severe limits in carrying out what CCRA defines as the necessities of daily living. And it's my understanding, too, that while the requirements taken in isolation, each one seems very severe, I think you can also qualify on the basis of the sum of the impact on the necessities of daily living. So if you have a small impact on each of the necessities or most of the necessities of daily living, you can argue that the sum is a substantial impact on the necessities of daily living.
That's correct. It's called an accumulative.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, so if the form's intimidating, you look at it and you say, my God, I'm not lying in the bed staring at the ceiling. Maybe some mornings you are and having a hard time getting up. Maybe some days that same condition gives you difficulty preparing meals. It gives you difficulty tying your shoes. It gives you a difficulty getting up and walking around. And the sum of it adds up. Even though it isn't constant, the sum of it adds up to a substantial impairment to meet your own needs of daily living and would qualify you for the disability tax credit. Yeah.
And in my experience is people often minimize, you know, their degree of pain or how their disability affects their lifestyle. And I want to impress on them that
no points for minimization here.
No, we want the worst case.
Yeah.
That's to facilitate an honest appraisal.
Okay.
and base it on that worst day.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And again, sometimes this has to be discussed with your family physician, because they don't often see you on your worst day.
No, you're probably inside on your worst day.
That's right.
Yeah. No, yeah, I would argue strongly, too, that it's an interactive effort, that you can't just hand the form to the family physician and count on him to get you your disability tax credit. He may have no idea what it's about. If he does have an idea what it's about, he may not think, subconsciously, he may not think you deserve it. He may not have the time to consider how you get it. You got to talk about what's required to get it, what he can validate, and if the case comes up, what he cannot, and still proceed towards getting this benefit. Don't hand a blank form to your physician. You probably didn't get your ODSP that way. You know? So, yeah, don't expect to get your disability tax credit that way. It's my experience. Expect though, even though it may be granted the first year, they may come back in 2 years and say, you know, clarify this for us. And, you know, your credit could be voided and you could have to pay it back, you know, sort of thing. And if you validate it the same way you got it, it's no problem. It's just the way the federal government works when it comes to taxes.
Yeah, it's you that dialogue with your physician, and it's often not understood by the physician the intrinsic benefit. It's so far reaching, and it wasn't until last week I had an opportunity to meet with some physicians, whereby I outlined the bigger picture.
Yeah,
and they had no idea that in the case of waiving their $25, $50 fee.
Mm-hmm, for a letter.
For a letter.
Or a form.
That it was such a huge impact in people's lives.
Yeah.
So it has to be underscored sometimes, and that's just through dialogue and interaction and,
mm-hmm,
you know, being empowered with information, and that is true with those that are, you know, with disabilities and our physicians as well.
Yeah, so you've applied for your disability tax credit. The government's grudgingly given it to you. They've also sent you a check for 9 years, 10 years back?
10 years.
10 years back. So what kind of check are you staring at if your tax permits the maximum deduction?
My average claim is in the 14,000 range.
And it's not income for benefits purposes. It's a tax refund.
That's correct.
So it's yours to spend as you wish. How do you propose we spend it?
Well, a happy recourse now is not only the Registered Disability Savings Plan, but there is the tax-favored savings plan as well,
mm-hmm,
that's in the marketplace.
Mm-hmm.
But the Registered Disability Savings Plan is a tremendous vehicle for those that have disabilities.
Now, there's an age at which that plan has to pay out, isn't there?
Well, as with most pension plans, there's a finite date for the disbursement of the money. In the year one turns 59, there's a realized pension at that point. But up until that point,
mm-hmm,
beneficiaries are able to
contribute. Yeah.
And in turn, depending on income thresholds, receive sources of monies from the government.
I understand those stop like 10 years before 59, that the government will chip in until you're like 49, and then they won't after that.
There's a 20-year contribution to maximize the grants of $1,000.
A year?
A year.
Okay.
And the personal contribution amounts are limited to $3,500 in government contributions. So, may I give you an example?
Yeah, yeah.
So we have a gentleman who's 29.
Mm-hmm.
And when one looks at eligibility for government grants, depending on income thresholds,
yeah,
20 years plus 29 is, yeah, 49.
Right.
During that period of time, in addition to the government grants,
right,
you have maximum matching of your contributions up to $3,500 a year.
But you get the grants whether you contribute or not.
Correct, depending on family income.
Right.
And there are thresholds of approximately $20,000, $40,000, and $75,000.
Okay.
And depending on the grant alone, there are clawbacks.
Okay.
But from a contribution and matching.
Oh, there's matching funds as well as grants. Oh, and they're like 100% matching?
Up to three times on the first 500 and two times on monies over $500.
So if you could put aside, say, $50 a month, except for December when you might want the money for Christmas shopping, I'm just brainstorming with this, and maybe January when you got your check 7 weeks before the next one. So 10 months, $50, $500, and you get $1,500 from the government, and then you get a grant of $1,000.
Correct.
Pretty nice.
If family income is below that $20,000 to $22,000 threshold.
And family meaning your personal family, you and your wife and your kids, whatever.
Yeah, so this gentleman I mentioned earlier is age 29, but let's say he's 18.
Yeah.
It would be then based on his income.
Right.
And we're well aware that those are on ODSP are making below the $20,000 threshold.
Right.
So this 18-year-old would be, in opening of an account, would get a direct deposit in the form of a bond of $1,000. He hasn't made any contribution.
Okay.
Using your example, he's now putting in $50 a month, which will allow him matching of $3 from the government for every dollar he contributes.
Right. Yeah.
That's $1,500 on his five.
So the government's throwing in $150 every month. He throws in $50. Yeah. Plus the bond that he gets to open it up.
Pretty exciting. All told, with his contributions, we're looking at $6,000 a year.
He puts in $500, and then the government puts in $1,000, and the government puts in $1,500. So that's $2,500 and $500 is $3,000. How do you get $6,000 out of this?
Well, if I may use your example of $50 a month for 10 months is a $500 contribution on your part.
Yeah.
Now, in a three-step process, let's just go back one step. The first step being, under a $22,000 threshold.
Mm-hmm. Income threshold, yeah.
There's an automatic bond of $1,000.
Okay.
Without making any contributions.
All right.
Now, jump ahead. You're making a $500 contribution.
Yeah.
$50 a month times 10.
Mm-hmm.
$500. The government will match $3 for every one.
Mm-hmm.
So another $1,500 will be deposited in that account. Now, in total now, we have a $1,000 bond plus your contribution of $500.
Yeah.
Plus a government matching of $1,500.
Okay. So you got $3,000 in it already.
Correct. Now, we want to maximize the $3,500 a year matching.
Okay.
So far, we've only matched $1,500.
Yeah.
The government will match $3,500.
Yeah.
In order to do that, you put in your initial $500. Anybody can contribute and top up another $1,000.
Right.
You, family, friends.
Yeah.
The government will match another $2,000. Okay. 2 to 1.
Okay.
Now we're maximizing their matching contribution total of $3,500. So in all total,
You've got your original $3,000, and then you've got your $1,000 contribution, which takes you up to $4,000. And then you've got the 2-for-1 matching of that $1,000 contribution, which takes you up to $4,000, $2,000, $6,000. Yeah, total.
Outstanding.
Yeah.
This is aside from any dividend interest or capital gain income, which is all tax deferred.
And hopefully ODSP isn't jealous of you having this money set aside, because the Act approves of it. Now, when it comes time to get this money out, who gets it?
It's there's a 10-year window.
Yep.
So there can't be any encroachment of funds for 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
Then there's a structured settlement or pension plan at that point. We won't go into detail the computation.
Okay.
But it's based on age and mortality.
Okay.
From that point.
Okay.
The key here is the 10-year, call it a locking in provision.
Okay.
And that will allow then you to take advantage of the buildup of the grants and the matching.
Okay.
Otherwise, there's going to be clawbacks.
Yeah, okay. Good. Well, sounds like a step towards income security that you can't argue with. If you can come up with that $50, maybe a family member to chip in that other 1,000. Or two of them, or five of them. You got a lot of brothers and sisters who like you. Okay. All right.
More information can be found. The institutions are coming on board. Their regulations took a while. The federal regs too. And then, of course, the institutions have to rev up their programs.
Yeah, there were 3 banks offered this plan when it was launched, maybe more by now. Okay.
So one can source specialists at each of these institutions, and if you're welcome to call me if there's any further questions, too.
What's your number?
905-523-4698.
905-523-4698. Can they reach you by email?
Correct. Lowercase, full first name and last name, David Blasick, BLAS, C as in Charlie, IK, at kojiko.ca.
David Blasick at kojiko.ca. Okay. Well, there's some answers for people who thought they didn't have any, and some money for people who thought they didn't have any. Maybe you still don't, but if you can find $50 a month, or you can find someone else to throw some money into this. For the younger listeners with disability, it sounds like a good deal. Thanks for coming in, David.
Not at all. Thank you.
Now for a break with Willie Mabon. Would you, babe?
A woodpecker pick low down dirty wood, knocking my brain, but man, I ain't doing no good. Do me a favor, darling, if you only would just love me, baby, and love me good. Take it, babe, make everything all right. Well, I'm standing on the corner, standing like a man, standing on the corner with my suitcase in my hand. Had you one time, darling, I'd let you go. But this time, baby's gonna be for sure. Take it, babe. Make everything all right. Thank you. you play? Would you play? Would you play? Make everything all right. All right.
Now for the weekly review of news on Disrespect. Remember, these are excerpts from articles. These are not the articles which are in the news that we read to you and under the reporters' names that we give you while we talk. Pfizer hit with record $2.3 billion penalty by Devlin Barrett in Washington. Federal prosecutors hit Pfizer Incorporated with a record-brereaking $2.3 billion U.S. in fines and called the world's largest drug maker a repeating corporate cheat for illegal drug promotions that plied doctors with free gifts, massages, resort junkets, and golf. Announcing the penalty is a warning to all drug manufacturers. Justice Department officials said the overall settlement is the largest ever paid by a drug company for alleged violations of federal drug rules, and the $1.2 billion criminal fine is the largest ever in any U.S. criminal case. The total includes $1 billion in civil penalties and a $100 million criminal forfeiture. Authorities called Pfizer a repeat offender, noting it is the company's fourth such settlement of government charges in the last decade. The allegations surround the marketing of 13 different drugs, including big sellers such as Viagra, Zoloft, and Lipitor. To prevent backsliding this time, Pfizer's conduct will be specially monitored by the Health and Human Service Department Inspector General for 5 years. Officials said the U.S. industry has paid out more than $11 billion in such settlements over the past decade, but one consumer advocate voiced hope that yesterday's penalty was so big it would curb the abuses. Walmart aims to silence workers. Corporation using trademark law in attempt to control website's content. By Wayne Hanley, the national president of the United Food and Commercial Workers Union in Canada. This from The Spectator on Friday, September 4th. Walmart Stores Incorporated is the world's largest and most influential corporation. If it were a country, Walmart's economy would be the 26th largest in the world, placing it ahead of Argentina, Greece, and Denmark. Nearly one out of every 100 working North Americans works for Walmart. As a corporation, its size, power, and wealth has few, if any, rivals in history, and its actions affect us all. On June 19th, Walmart filed an injunction request with the Quebec Superior Court against the website Walmart Workers Canada. Since 2003, this informational website has been owned and operated by the United Food and Commercial Workers Union in Canada, UFCW Canada. It was successful in its mandate to help Walmart workers in Canada learn about their rights as workers and to share their stories about working for Walmart. Walmart's injunction request seeks to use trademark law to impose a broad list of orders onto the website. If successful, the site will be prohibited from using Walmart's name, color scheme, a parody of Walmart's slogan, or any photograph of a person wearing any blue vest. The site would also have to abandon its established web address. Most absurdly, they demand the site not use certain oval, circular, or semicircular designs. Given Walmart's famous anti-union ideology, it's not surprising they feel threatened by a website that tells workers how to form a union, among other things. We are concerned that if the injunction is granted, it would impede our ability to effectively communicate with these workers. Any attempt to censor an independent website should raise serious questions about the freedom of expression and freedom of association in the digital world. We cannot allow a corporation to determine what is and what is not appropriate content on a not-for-profit informational website. Citizens and working people are increasingly turning to the web to exercise their freedoms of expression and association. The culture of Labor Day gives a special significance to this legal battle. On the first Monday of each September, we pay tribute to the battles workers have fought and to the gains they've made on history, shop floors, and picket lines. Working people today continue to fight for their collective rights, which are under constant assault in the globalized world. This fight against Walmart is one such battle. UFCW Canada hopes it will help keep the Internet a truly free place where workers can come together to exercise their freedom of expression and association without fear of reprisal. If we can come together to defeat Walmart's injunction, we will send a strong message to the corporate world. Your most powerful and influential member tried to restrict our ability to effectively communicate with each other online, and they failed. If such a precedent is set, other corporations will be less likely to make further attempts to divide us online, and next Labor Day, we'll have one more victory to celebrate. The Hamilton Spectator, again, Friday, September 4th, Labor Day highlights trying times, by Keith Leslie. Downturn used as excuse for cuts, unions. More than 400,000 more Canadians will be unemployed this Labor Day than last, and while the economists say the recession is over, job losses are expected to continue well into next year. What's worse, many of those who lost their jobs don't qualify for employment insurance. The EI Fund had a $57 billion surplus that was spent by Liberal and Conservative governments. Canadian Labour Congress President Ken Giorgetti said the understanding was that they could spend the surplus, but when the funds were needed, they would borrow money if necessary and not cut people off EI benefits, he said. Workers know they didn't cause the recession, and that's why they're willing to strike if they think an employer is demanding concessions that aren't really necessary, Giorgetti said. A bitter strike shut down Vail, Inco's nickel mines in Sudbury over company concession demands. City workers' strikes in Toronto and Windsor this spring and summer were also sparked by concession demands, and workers in the battered auto sector were forced to make significant concessions, including a long wage freeze, before the federal and Ontario governments agreed to provide billions of dollars in aid to GM and Chrysler to keep the companies alive. With pension costs mounting, companies in a variety of interests have tried to reduce their payments to corporate pension plans, knocking heads with their unions. Both the Labour Congress and the Canadian Auto Workers say the recession highlighted the fragile economic conditions faced by many Canadian seniors, especially after the pension plans took major losses in the markets and some plans were found to be woefully underfunded. Congress will launch a campaign Monday to double benefits under the Canada Pension Plan within 15 years by charging employers and employees each a 2.5% increase in premiums. In the last two quarters, the majority of entrants into the job market were people 58 and older, meaning that the pensions they received when they retired are inadequate, Giorgetti said. 60% of Canadians don't have a company pension plan, noted CAW President Ken Lewenza. If we got anything out of this global financial crisis, it's an understanding that seniors are the most vulnerable in terms of their life savings and in terms of their kind of social benefits provided to Canadians, he said. And you remember this, the autistic boy who got thrown off the bus. Well, he got an apology. This from The Spectator, courtesy of Canadian Press. Public Transit Authority in Halifax will issue a formal apology to an autistic boy after his family complained about a bus driver who refused to drive unless the child stopped screaming, his mother says. Charlene Croft said Metro Transit agreed to write an apology for her son Isaac after she and her husband met with transit officials. A Metro Transit spokesperson didn't call the company's response an apology. She said Metro Transit agreed to send Isaac a letter acknowledging that any incident like this is unfortunate. And now for a break with Howlin' Wolf, I Had a Dream.
I had a dream Monday night. I had a dream Monday night. I had it in my sleep. When I woke up this morning, what I dreamed was gone. I dreamed I had a heaven, and I sat well on the throne. I dreamed I had a heaven, and I sat well on the throne. The women would come to see me. I had a heaven of my own. Oh yeah.
Ontario pumping $150 million into legal aid system. This from the Canadian Press, again in The Spectator, by Keith Leslie. Ontario's legal aid system will get a $150 million increase in funding over the next 4 years as the Liberal government moves to stop a growing protest by defense lawyers and Crown attorneys. Attorney General Chris Bentley will announce a long-awaited modernization and renewal package for Legal Aid Ontario on Tuesday. That was last Tuesday. A legal aid boycott that began with defense lawyers in Toronto in June has spread to Kingston, Thunder Bay, and London, with attorneys complaining they aren't getting enough funding to try large, complicated trials such as murder and guns and gangs cases. The province will create a new major case management office to build up expertise for such trials, which Bentley said account for only 10% of criminal cases, but about 25% of the legal aid budget. The majority of legal aid money actually goes to single mothers who are living below the poverty line and dealing with the justice system, said a government source. The funding for Legal Aid Ontario will increase by $15 million this year, $30 million next year, and after the election will grow to $45 million in 3 years and finally by $60 million in the fourth year. Meanwhile, out in the street, excited delirium is a real risk, Nova Scotia report into taser death warns. This by Oliver Moore in Halifax from The Globe. Excited delirium is real, and anyone showing symptoms of it should be considered at risk of sudden death, according to a report commissioned by the Nova Scotia government. Does it exist as a medical diagnosis? That's a useless discussion. The phenomenon exists. Stan Kuchar, an expert in adolescent medical health at Dalhousie University's Department of Psychiatry, said. The point is, what is this phenomenon? How can we best identify it? How can we best intervene? According to the report given to the government in June and released publicly Friday, first responders should try to de-escalate the situation and negotiate when dealing with a person in excited delirium. But if physical restraint proves necessary, it must be done as rapidly and safely as possible because a long struggle may pose greater risk to the subject. The authors do not specify what form that restraint should take, and that raised concerns for a lawyer acting for the family of Howard Hyde, a paranoid schizophrenic Dartmouth man who died in custody 30 hours after being tasered by police. From what I can see, the police handling Mr. Hyde felt that they were doing just that by using the taser, Kevin McDonald said. That's seen as the quickest and safest way to restrain someone. Justice Minister Ross Landry said that more research needs to be done to determine whether there should be greater restrictions and how the stun weapons are used. The panel, which was struck last fall, included Nova Scotia Chief Medical Examiner Dr. Matthew Boyce, who found that Mr. Hyde's death was caused by excited delirium because of his mental illness. It was tasked with cutting through what the government viewed as public confusion surrounding the condition. Story of the season, Globe, Friday, September 4th. H1N1 virus hits children 5 to 18 the hardest. This is by Carolyn Alfonso. The H1N1 pandemic virus is deadliest among school-aged children, a departure from the seasonal flu, which is more often fatal to babies and toddlers, early indicators from U.S. health authorities show. The findings from the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention come as health authorities brace for the start of the school year, fearing that classrooms will serve as incubators for the swine flu virus to spread rapidly. Influenza deaths are generally rare in children, but the study of 36 lab-confirmed swine flu deaths in children suggests that those over the age of 5 are among the groups who are at the greatest risk of being severely infected by the new virus and as a result should be first in line to be vaccinated. More than 80% of the pediatric deaths from H1N1 were among children between the ages of 5 and 18. The analysis found in a normal flu season, half or more of the children who die are babies and toddlers. Even more significantly, the agency found that children with underlying medical disabilities had a higher risk of being severely infected and succumbing to the virus. Almost two-thirds of U.S. children who died with swine flu had epilepsy, cerebral palsy, or other neurodevelopmental conditions. In a previous flu season, only a third of pediatric deaths had those conditions. Child deaths from influenza are really tragic, Thomas Frieden, director of the U.S. Centers for Disease Control, told reporters in a news briefing. If children have underlying conditions, and two-thirds of the children in this report had conditions such as muscular dystrophy and cerebral palsy, it's very important that they be treated promptly. And if a child is severely ill, if they're having trouble breathing, if their fever comes back after it went away, if they are having difficulty keeping fluids down, then it's very important to get treated promptly. The virus, which first appeared in April, has caused relatively mild disease, but health authorities have noted that it's disproportionately affected younger people, unlike seasonal flu that mainly burdens the elderly. Canada's ordered 50 million doses of the H1N1 vaccine for all those who need and want it. Health authorities have indicated a list of those who should receive it first will be released in the middle of the month. Immunization in childhood, given the risks, is going to be an important part of the program, Canada's chief public health officer, Dr. Butler Jones, said yesterday. And by Chintapuxley in Winnipeg. Some regions not ready for second wave of swine flu. Some regions in Canada squandered a golden opportunity this summer and are not as prepared as they should be for an expected second wave of swine flu, some experts say. Anand Kumar, a Manitoba intensive care specialist who worked when the virus first hit last spring, said the province learned the hard way how to deal with an overwhelming flood of patients. But despite calls for help and shared research from other hospitals across Canada, Manitoba found only complacency, said Dr. Kumar, who also teaches at the University of Manitoba. Health ethics boards were saying, "What's the hurry? We'll start the research in the fall. It's something that really bothers me." David Butler Jones, Canada's chief public health officer, said if some health authorities don't have a plan, now is the time, but he believes many regions did draw from the country's experience in the spring, and Canada is now readier than we've ever been for a resurgence. Frank Plummer, scientific director of Canada's National Microbiology Laboratory, said conferences like the one that just ended in Winnipeg are an important part of flu preparations. The conference should fill some research gaps by answering questions such as how long patients remain in intensive care, he said. That is of very, very practical importance to ICUs because managing someone in isolation is very resource intensive, and if they don't have to be isolated, you can use those resources somewhere else. Editorial from The Spectator, do we need H1N1 vaccines additive? This is a letter to The Spec from Gene Turton in Hamilton. It was featured in Letters at The Spec regarding a letter September 2nd, what's safer, H1N1 flu or vaccine? For at least 15 years, I've had annual vaccinations against seasonal influenza. During that time, I've had no side effects and no flu. However, I'm having a great deal of difficulty believing that the pharmaceutical companies developing the H1N1 vaccine, GlaxoSmithKline in Canada, have our best interests at heart. The reason for my skepticism is the addition of an adjuvant, squalene, to the vaccine itself. Now, squalene is an oil-water molecule with a twofold purpose: to enhance the immunity property provided by the vaccine in the body and thus to make dose-sparing possible. In other words, less vaccine per person means more people can be vaccinated. Sound altruistic? Squalene occurs naturally in the body. It's essential to us in our diet, but when it's injected, it can turn the body's immune system against itself. Squalene was used as an adjuvant in the anthrax vaccines given to all Gulf War personnel before deployment to the Persian Gulf. Subsequently, an alarming percentage of vaccine recipients have been diagnosed with Gulf War syndrome, which includes a broad range of autoimmune diseases, including rheumatoid arthritis, multiple sclerosis, lupus, and ALS. Pharmaceutical companies will be monitoring side effects of H1N1 test subjects for several weeks before giving the go-ahead for mass vaccinations this fall, beginning, we are told, with healthcare workers, children, and those with compromised immune systems. Unfortunately, autoimmune diseases do not manifest themselves in a matter of days or weeks. Fortunately, seasonal flu vaccines have not been adjuvanted. Apparently, the Canadian H1N1 vaccine is being manufactured separately from the adjuvant squalene. However, the plan is that the two will simply be combined at the time of vaccination. It seems to me that we need some reassurance about the safety of the adjuvant squalene before fall. Lung damage severe among flu dead, Hamilton Spectator, Friday, September 4th. H1N1 patients' bodies looked more like avian flu victims, by Helen Branswell. The lungs of people who have died from swine flu look more like those of the victims of H5N1 avian influenza than those of people who succumb to regular flu, the chief of infectious diseases pathology at the U.S. Centers for Disease Control says. Study of about 70 fatal H1N1 cases so far also reveals there may be more incidences of co-infections with the bacteria than was earlier thought, Dr. Sheriff Zaki said. The dangerous avian flu virus has killed 60% of 440 people known to have been infected with it. To date, though, the virus hasn't acquired the capacity to spread easily from person to person. The swine flu patients who later died suffered lung damage and changes in the lungs that would have made it difficult to deliver enough oxygen into their bloodstream, Zaki says. That reflects the observation of intensive care doctors who've struggled to save these profoundly ill patients. Roughly 90% of the cases studied at the conference had underlying medical conditions. A separate report issued by the CDC revealed that 67% of the 36 American children who died from swine flu had at least one high-risk medical condition, such as cerebral palsy and muscular dystrophy. Extreme obesity was the top one, and then hypertension, high blood pressure, or chronic cardiac conditions, asthma. Those were the top three. Dr. Diana Blau, who works with Zaki, says of the adult cases, others included diabetes and immune deficiencies. Zaki says doctors treating people with these kind of conditions to let patients know so they respond quickly if they catch the virus and get really sick. Zaki says about a third of the fatal cases his team has reviewed involved co-infection with a bacterium. The report on deaths in children revealed there were also significant rates of bacterial co-infections among the children who died of swine flu. It said doctors should be aware and treat children with antibiotics if co-infections are found. That's an important message for doctors to know, that if someone has the flu, they get better, then they get worse again with high fever. That's a clue that maybe they should be treated with antibiotics, said CDC Director Dr. Thomas Frieden during a medical briefing. And a little more optimistically, again in the Spectator, Friday, September 4th, Discovery Gives Hope in Search for HIV Vaccine by Joseph Hall. The long-thwarted dream of an AIDS vaccine has been given a major shot in the arm with a new study that's rekindled hope among many experts that they're on track to an effective protection against the pandemic scourge. After years of fruitless searching, research report in the journal Science that they may have finally exposed an Achilles heel for HIV. In the new paper, scientists say they have found a furtive piece of the organism that remains unchanged through more than 75% of HIV mutations, offering a new and promising target for inoculation. While it could be years before the findings can be translated into a vaccine, if ever, the studies validated a strategy of using the immune system's antibody response mechanisms to create effective protection, says Dr. Kelly McDonald, director of the University of Toronto's HIV research program. I would say it gives those of us in the field of vaccine a reason to believe that there's still some reason to go after the old antibody approach. McDonald, who's been front and center in the global search for an AIDS vaccine, did not contribute to the paper. This principle that we've been struggling and working towards for 15 years has been the right idea. We haven't been wasting our time, thank God. The pair of previously unknown antibodies, which were revealed in the paper, discovered in the blood of an unidentified African AIDS patient and known as PG9 and PG16, appear to neutralize HIV's ability to infect its immune cells targets in almost 80% of cases. And on the lightest note of all, from Britain, by Paul Byrne, this in the Daily Mirror. A diabetic woman whose badly infected leg was amputated has been refused disability benefits in case it got better. Former nurse Beryl Prescott, 57, was told to reapply in 3 months when it would be decided if she was genuinely disabled. Beryl said, apparently you have to wait 3 months after you come out of hospital before you can apply in case you get better. I'm not a doctor, but I'm pretty sure that's not going to happen. I don't have a magic grow bag. She added, I'm not a fraudster. I'm not trying it on. I'm 100% genuine case. I have a prosthetic leg. partially sighted barrel had her leg amputated in January. She applied for disability living allowance from her hospital bed, but was told it would be a 3-month wait before her claim was even processed. Beryl from Crossens near Southport, Merseyside, said, "It sickens me that you do your best and pay your bills all your life and then you get treated with no respect." The government insists on a 3-month qualifying period before awarding DLA. Claimants must be unable or nearly unable to walk due to a permanent disability, the loss of one or both limbs, or being partially sighted. A spokesman for the Department of Work and Pensions, which has given Beryl more than £1,700 in back payments, said, "We cannot comment on individual cases." And that's the news this week for Disrespect. Come back next week. We'll have more for you. And now going out, we have Boston Driving Blues with Bob Margolin.
You'll run out of gas and starve and die. But now the South is home, you see. I learned to drive in Boston, but now the South is home, you see. Down there they think I'm crazy, but I don't care, they can't catch me.
You can now listen to the show wherever you're near the internet. Disrespect is streamed live at http://cfmu.msumcmaster.ca. You can email us at dialogue, D-I-A-L-O-G-U-E, at radio.fm. Disrespect is archived at www.radioforall.net. That's the number four, not the word, radioforall.net. You can find the shows under its name, Disrespect. Tune in at Showtime, Thursdays at noon, 93.3 FM, CFMU, to see if something more topical hasn't displaced the show that we planned. Disrespect is digitally edited from live telephone and studio interviews.